Blog Talk Radio.
Exposing the lies.
The lies.
Shattering the consensus. Highlighting the hypocrisy. Global Cooling Radio with Mark Gillar.
Good morning and welcome to Global Cooling Radio. This is Mark Gillar, and we are very honored today to have Steve Gorham on our show. Steve is an engineer. He's got 30 years of experience at Fortune 100 public companies. He's a whitewater kayaker, so he has an appreciation for the environment. And most importantly to us today, he is the author of Climatism, Science, Common Sense, and the 21st Century's Hottest Topic. Steve, welcome to Global Cooling Radio.
Good morning, Mark. Delighted to join you.
We're delighted to have you here. I thought what might be fun for us today is to take a look at the American Power Act, and I've downloaded a few pages of that from John Kerry's website, so you know it's true. And I was looking at some of the claims that were made in the very first couple of pages of the bill, and I thought what we might do, since you cover a lot of these topics in your book, is just sort of go down this list of claims one by one that are being put at the front of this bill to make it seem like a very urgent piece of legislation that needs to be passed. Would that be okay with you?
That would be great.
Okay, let's take a look at this. It's actually on page 11 that we see a laundry list, if you will, of these various doom and gloom scenarios that are going to take place if we don't immediately stop driving cars and flying in airplanes. The first one says we're going to see an increase in outbreaks from waterborne diseases. What are your thoughts on that?
It's amazing that this thing... As a matter of fact, Paul Reiter, who's an expert, formerly with CDC and a long list of accomplishments on transmitted diseases and waterborne diseases, talks about this, and he says it's amazing this stuff can go on and on and on. The IPCC of the United Nations, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has indicated that their position on disease is that it's not really very clear-cut. But we have folks like the World Bank that are talking about malaria, talking about a lot of other diseases that will spread with higher temperatures, but completely unfounded and completely disputed by the experts in the industry.
I actually have communicated with Paul a little bit, and we need him now more than ever because this seems to be the one claim that they're scaring everyone with. That we're going to see more malaria coming from mosquitoes and so forth. And ironically, the most deaths from malaria have come from a environmental action, as you well know. So I think it's interesting that they're trying to scare people into signing on board to cap and trade with threats of malaria when the last time 30 million people died from malaria, it was because of the actions of environmentalists, not because of a lack of action. Now, that's absolutely. And the next item on their list, and I'll just combine two of them, we're going to see more droughts and more floods. What are your thoughts on that?
Again, the people that make these claims don't look at the history and the information we have. I talk about this quite a bit in the book. If you look, for example, if you take the United States data from the U.S. Climate Change Department, you see they have some graphs of the extremely wet conditions and a graph of extremely dry conditions from the year 1900 to the present. And when you take a look at this graph, you see there is no trend. We actually had more drought in the 30s and the 1950s, and there have been several extremely wet periods in the early 1900s. There are also studies around the world, people that have studied the recent droughts in Africa and the history. There have been droughts in Ethiopia and East Africa about 20 years long. Scientists have shown from proxy information that we've had droughts lasting hundreds of years not too long ago, within the last 500 to 700 years. So if you actually look at the history of the Earth from around the world and the geological studies that have been done, there is no indication that droughts and floods are more prevalent. But yet, every time we have a flood in North Dakota, Al Gore, claims this is a global warming phenomenon.
Well, you know, in case we have some Al Gore supporters listening today, can you verify for me then that floods and droughts actually took place before the Industrial Revolution and before man started emitting CO2?
Well, they absolutely do, and I put a lot of information in the book on that. Matter of fact, many of these things are tied. The droughts in Africa are cycled very closely with cycles in the Atlantic multi-decadal oscillation. The floods and droughts in Southeast Asia are very closely tied to El Nino that's been going on for more than 1,000 years. So the cycles of the Earth are what drive these processes, not a trace gas in the atmosphere, carbon dioxide.
Now, I find this next item on the Kerry list kind of interesting. It says diminished agricultural production. The last time I checked, CO2 was actually good for plants. Talk to us about that. What about this claim?
Absolutely, many studies about that. Recently, William Happer testified before the United States Congress. I think that was May 20th, talked about that and how carbon dioxide is great for the environment. There are also studies recently done by SPPI that talk about that. Carbon dioxide causes plants to grow, causes them to be hardier, able to survive drought conditions. And the more plants they are, the more the better it is for the animals that feed on the plants and the biosphere. This whole idea that we're going to end up with worse ecological conditions. Another factor I should mention is that if it gets warmer, we end up with warmer areas like the tropics. The tropics are areas where we have the highest biodiversity and the best area for plant growth. So this idea that we're going to end up with droughts and the plants aren't going to grow really is nonsense.
So far, we've thrown out, I guess, 3 or 4 claims, and so far, all of them shot down. Let's take on another one. According to Kerry and Boxer and some of the other Democrats in Washington, we are going to see more wildfires as a result of global warming, which itself is due to man-made CO2 emissions. What are your thoughts on that?
I can't really comment on that, Mark. The connection to that has to be extremely tenuous, but that's not something I can really comment on. I know we've had many fires in Australia, and a lot of people are claiming that's due to global warming, but how they get there is beyond me.
In the U.S., I know that, for example, Ian Murray at CEI has suggested that it's actually environmental policies that are keeping, things like the low-level brush from being burned away every so often, that is allowing a lot of fuel for these fires to get stored up. And he's actually blaming the environmentalists for the wildfires that we have seen because of some of the policies that they've been successful at getting enacted. Let's move on. Go ahead.
I was going to say,
of course,
many of our congressmen are also taking that position because are opposing some of the policies of the Forestry Service and others, but they can't seem to get some common sense policies across that would allow us to stop this buildup of brush and a forest fire situation.
Well, even the Native Americans, just using common sense, would oftentimes set fires to clear away the low-level brush because they understood the importance of taking care of it before it got out of hand. It's amazing that, a couple of hundred years later, we've got people, elected officials, who don't get that. Well, now let's talk about one of my favorites, especially given one of Al Gore's recent real estate purchases, and that is global warming is going to lead to, and I'm quoting this directly, a substantial rise in sea levels due in part to melting mountain glaciers, shrinking sea ice, and thawing permafrost.
Yeah, that's clearly the biggest disaster that everybody's concerned about, and we always see the when we look on PBS or any of the main television news channels, they're always showing pictures of melting ice or calving glaciers or something like that. I go through that quite a bit in the book. Your viewers, I think, know a lot of this, but there's a huge amount of evidence that we don't have a situation of the ice caps disappearing. We did have a 30-year low in 2007 of Arctic ice, but, of course, at the same time, the media didn't report the 30-year high of Antarctic ice. One of the things in the book, you know, we always see this PBS with water pouring down through the crevasse showing that Greenland is melting. If your listeners have not heard about the P-38 Glacier Girl, they can go to that site and take a look at that. The quick story is that when we were ferrying planes to England in 1942, eight of them had to crash land on Greenland. The pilots and crews were all rescued, and then an expedition went back, actually three expeditions in the 1980s, and they couldn't find the planes, although they should have been. They knew right where they were. Finally, the last expedition went back in the early 90s with sophisticated subsurface radar and found the planes were buried under 270 feet of ice. So in 50 years, yeah, they actually dug there's a picture in the book of the P-38 Glacier Girl down in an ice cave 270 feet below the surface. They tunneled down, they disassembled it, carried it out, it's flown at air shows. But the bottom line is that the ice on Greenland is thickening in the center. It's melting somewhat around the edges because we have had recent warmer temperatures, but it's certainly not disappearing. And sea level rise has been a steady 7 inches per year over about the last 150 years. It's gone up a little and down a little, but the trend has been fairly flat. And sea levels have been rising since the last ice age, 20,000 years ago. But certainly not being driven by carbon dioxide.
So where does Al Gore get his sea levels are going to rise by 20 feet in the next 100 years figure from?
Yeah, Al's at 20 feet and James Hansen's at 20 feet and even the IPCC has a mean value of 15 inches by the year 2100. So their projections are much less than Al and James. They're basically saying if the Greenland ice cap melts or if the Arctic ice cap melts, then we'll get these big sea level rises. But there's no evidence that these ice caps are melting.
Well, again, if Al Gore actually believes that, then he just made one heck of a bad real estate purchase. I think this is his second beachfront property
is it
that
really
he's purchased. In the,
or, you know,
well, no, I think it's relatively close.
And it could be up on
it's
a bluff or something, so. So I'm not really sure. Yeah, if he's 10 foot from the, if he's 10 foot from the ocean, that'd be a bad purchase, but...
I think you're giving Al too much credit. Al's laughing all the way to the bank. And, you know, speaking of that, talk to the listeners a little bit. It's funny because anytime, you know, I have someone like yourself on the show, or even if I go out and venture out into the blogosphere and take on some of these people that support Al Gore, the first thing they do is accuse the skeptic of having financial ties to ExxonMobil or to Big Coal or, you know, pick your favorite oil company, you know, just any energy group, Koch Industries, whatever. But yet no one seems to want to connect the dots between the global warming alarmist and Goldman Sachs and, you know, General Electric and those companies that stand to make many billions if the U.S. actually signs on to cap and trade. So talk to us, help us connect some of those dots to see what's really going on here behind the scenes, and maybe perhaps give us an idea as to where some of the alarmists or the warmists are getting their money from.
Well, Mark, I really don't want to get into all that. The thing that amazes me about all these criticisms and claims about Lindzen and Singer and a lot of these scientists, I don't think the people that they're making these attacks have actually met the folks. I don't think they've heard them. I've spent the last couple of years talking to some of these folks and gone to the conferences. I was at the recent Heartland conference, and these folks aren't doing this to be paid by the oil companies. They've been ostracized in many ways. And I think you're right. The dollars are huge on the side of all the universities, all the government grants. It's amazing that NOAA and NASA and all these organizations are still pushing the political line. They've just got too much of a stake involved, though, in the millions, hundreds of millions, and billions of dollars they're getting from the federal government on this. I think we need to stick to the science, and we need to stick to the economics, and get away from the attacks on both sides. If we're going to sort this thing out,
I think that's a very good idea. I think what we see are the skeptics, for the most part, trying to stick to the science, and the accusations tend to come from the other side. I can honestly say I've never received a dime from Big Oil or Big Coal or anybody else that might have a financial stake in this, and I know that many of the people that I've had on my show are in the exact same boat, and I personally think if one wanted to, were doing this for the money, then those of us who are skeptics are on the wrong side.
Well, I think you're right, and if you look at the position of the scientists that have been outspoken on this, they've had their careers damaged in many cases. They've been fired from positions all over the world. It's not a path to fame and fortune to be a skeptic. So it takes a lot of courage, and it's not the oil. And by the way, all the Fortune 500 now are all following the political line here. And it's too bad more of these companies don't have some courage. But I went to a Motorola shareholders meeting 5 weeks ago, my former company, and I stood up and politely said, you know, your climate policy is nonsense. They're counting their carbon, and they're out buying renewable energy at expensive prices, and they're hurting shareholder value. But they've signed up because they think it's probably correct, and also from a public relations point of view, to keep the environmentalists off their back. So we have just about all the companies in the world are signed up on the side of this nonsense. So the argument is misguided.
Well, you said they need to find their courage. I don't think I can repeat on the air what Ann McElhaney said in Dallas about what they need to do. But the bottom line is, whether they're doing it because they believe it, or whether they're doing it because it's good PR, or whether or not they've been, you know, basically blackmailed behind the scenes by the environmentalists, the fact is, you're right. I mean, all the major companies, and not just oil companies, seem to be on board with this, and it's really upsetting, I think, that people are just taking the path of least resistance.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you have a sophisticated group of listeners on this show. If they've listened to the other experts who know far more about this topic than I do that you've had on, Al Michaels and others, they need to get out to these companies. They need to go to the shareholder meeting of their company. They need to challenge the company a little bit. The environmentalists have been doing this for years and have had a pretty straight path to pounding all these companies into submission. The skeptical crowd really needs to get more active.
One of the ways to do that might be to tie in with the Tea Party movement somewhat. I know a number of people have sort of branched off of the Tea Party movement and done green Tea Parties to do exactly the type of thing that you're talking about. And I think it would be great if we could capture some of that energy and some of that enthusiasm, because, you know, if you go down the list of pending legislation that could be very damaging, of course, we've already had the big one go through, but certainly cap and trade is something that really could damage our country in terms of taking a bad economy and making it much, much worse. Tell me if I'm wrong on this, but the estimates I've I've seen are that somewhere in the neighborhood of an $1,100 to $1,700 increase per year in the average family's electric bill will take place if cap and trade goes through. Is that consistent with estimates that you're hearing?
I think that's true, and I think the total cost there's going to be additional fuel prices, gasoline, et cetera. I think the total cost to a family is $2,500 to $3,000 per year. But it's not only at the federal level. We already have a renewable portfolio standard mandates. RPS is a marvelous device that forces the utilities of a state to buy renewable energy at inflated prices, a certain percentage of their energy, and then pass it on to consumers. We have RPS standards in 29 states, and it's already going to be raising. It is raising electric rates. I know out in California they have this AB 32 law. If any of your listeners are out there today, they need to get out and speak out against that. They have something on the ballot this fall that's going to roll back or put AB 32 on hold until the employment rate gets down. AB 32 is going to do nothing for reducing global warming. Even if the state meets its goals, it's a tenth or two of degrees Fahrenheit by 2050 is very, very small. So it's going to do nothing, but it's going to impose all kinds of restrictions and costs on Californians. People need to get out and battle that situation. We've got another situation here in Evanston where they're going to build a bunch of windmills out in Lake Michigan. It's been proposed by student group at the University of Northwestern, and you know they think they're doing something to stop the globe from warming up and help the environment, and just another misguided situation.
I think that brings up an important point, Steve, and that is at the bottom level. We tend to talk about the people at the top of these environmental groups, and you know the politicians and the global banks and the heads of these environmental groups sort of being, going through the motions in terms of the environmentalism, and what they're really all about is money and power. But at the bottom, you know, when you talk about the students and the average person who holds a sign for Greenpeace, they really are trying to do what they believe is right. I mean, they certainly think they're helping the environment, and they want to feel good knowing that, you know, they're being good stewards of the planet that God has entrusted us with. These students are probably the perfect example of that. They're going to put up windmills. I don't know that anywhere they've done windmills around the world, they've been able to close a single power plant because the wind doesn't always blow. But okay. you see these people, and you know what you're really doing for the most part is putting or contributing to an industry that absolutely can't even begin to survive without heavy government subsidization or subsidies. Rather, I don't know what to say, but they're. If we could tap into their need to do something good and make them understand that what they're doing actually isn't helping, I think that would be a huge victory for us. But you tell me your thoughts.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think listeners need to know that there's a war on energy going on, a war on energy use in the U.S. and around the world. And at the Heartland Conference, everybody, I think, was pretty upbeat that the skeptics are winning the battle on science. Unfortunately, we're winning that battle, but losing the war on energy. And the United States is a perfect example. We haven't had a license granted for a nuclear power plant since 1996. We haven't had a new refinery built for 30 years. We've had, according to the Sierra Club, more than 100 coal plants stopped in the last 2 years. We have this great new fracking technology to get the natural gas out of rock, but the environmentalists are opposing that and trying to get that stopped for the EPA. We can't drill offshore. 85% of our oil is offshore. ANWR is closed off the coast of Alaska. It just goes on and on and on, and the goal is that ration energy and suppress consumption in society. So we have a war on energy going on, and there are just as big a misconceptions about the energy situation, viability, really not non-viability of wind and solar power, as there are about the climate science. And people need to understand that, and your sophisticated listeners need to get out and get some common sense into the United States policies.
Oh, absolutely, and I think another thing, we're going to be putting up some links soon to a project that Anne McElhaney, I'm sure you know her and Phelan McAleer for their movie Not Evil, Just Wrong. They're working to create lesson plans for teachers so that children can get some balanced information on climate change and energy, and I think that's very important because in the schools at just about every level from kindergarten through grad school, they're only being given one side of the story. So in addition to going out there and talking to the politicians and talking to your neighbors, have a talk with your kids and have a talk with your kids' school.
Absolutely.
I think that's a good idea. Now, we've got about 4 minutes left. I want to talk to you about Chapter 14 in your book, Chains for Developing Nations. As I have said to people before, just once I would like to see some of that environmental compassion or some of the compassion on the part of environmentalists spill over to these people in third world countries who are burning dung to cook and burning dung to heat themselves and stay warm. Talk to us about these chains for developing nations, Steve.
Yeah, absolutely right. The biggest tragedy in terms of disease and in terms of shortened life expectancy and all those sorts of things is what's happening in the developing nations. And while in the United States and in the West, we may get higher gasoline prices, higher electric bills, all that is a serious situation. It's a real life and death issue in the developing world. There's something called the Equator Principles that I discuss in my book, and basically, the environmental groups over the last 10 years have forced all of the major banks of the world to adopt something called the Equator Principles, which means that they will only lend capital, they will only lend money to projects in the developing nations that are environmentally responsible. There is some good element to that, but increasingly that's become don't lend if it's on a coal plant. Don't lend if it's on an oil refinery. Don't lend if it's on hydrocarbons. Don't lend if it's on nuclear. Don't lend if it's on large banks. We just had a case within the last 2 months when the World Bank did grant a loan to the nation of South Africa for a coal-fired plant, $3.9 billion. But the representative from the United States voted against that loan. The representative from the United Kingdom voted against that loan. And so here we are taking it was passed because the developing nations outvoted the U.S. and the U.K. But here we are taking a position that South Africa, people without electricity, people without refrigerators, who are therefore prone to food spoilage disease, even hospitals in some locations in Africa don't have electricity for refrigeration, but we're going to say, well, you know, you can't have these plants because they might be warming the, you can't have build these plants because they might be warming the planet, and so we are condemning people to disease and suffering, and I was looking for a quote from Paul Dreesen here in his book Eco-Imperialism. To block the construction of centralized power projects is not being appropriate or sustainable is to condemn billions of people to continued poverty and disease and millions to premature death. So the Western nations, driven by environmentalism, driven by climatism, are putting chains on the developing nations, and this is the real tragedy of climatism.
Absolutely, and I think if a lot of those foot soldiers that are volunteers for environmental groups understood that better, they would switch sides. We've got about a minute left, Steve. Tell our listeners how they can get a hold of your book and how they can get a hold of you if they should wish to hire you as a speaker for an event.
Okay. The listeners first should remember climatism is a belief that man-made greenhouse gases are destroying Earth's climate. Now, the book can be found on Amazon or at my website, www.climatism.net. And please contact me through the website if you want me to come out and talk to your group.
fantastic. We are going to put even more links to your site after the show today. Steve, I want to thank you for being with us. Just a fantastic book. I would encourage that everyone out there grab a copy of it, and when you're through reading it, loan it to your neighbor, loan it to your children, donate a copy of it to your children's school library. Let's start, or send one to your local representatives. Let's start fighting back. Steve, once again, thanks for being with us. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Mark. Anytime. My pleasure.
Fantastic.